Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. My name is Brett Winton. I am ARK Invest's chief futurist and the host of FYI. With me today, I have the man, the myth, the legend, Charlie Roberts. Charlie is our chief investment strategist and a multi-time founder in the multi-omics space. Charlie, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Brett. Yeah, very well, thank you. And excited to talk about and show listeners some of the amazing insights from this great, great biotech team that we're talking to today.
Yeah, so today we spoke to Absci, which is a company that is really driving for drug discovery with artificial intelligence. Charlie, why don't you share who we spoke with?
We spoke with Andreas Busch, who's actually the chief innovation officer. And, you know, I think one of the big failings we see sometimes in the machine learning for bio space is, you know, what you could think of as machine learning hubris, where maybe the whole mission and everything is being led only by machine learning and by technology, but not enough by bio insights. And so it's really good and reassuring to see people of Andreas Busch's caliber in the drug discovery, drug development world. So he's had major R&D roles. Now at Absci, as chief innovation officer and leading a lot of the R&D, but historically in many of the big pharma with, you know, very, very high execution, high quality. So he's been in Sanofi and Bayer and Shire. His leadership has actually resulted in over 10 commercial drugs, which is a really high hit rate, or just overall performance, starting from bench right through to the FDA approval. And with several others in late stage clinical development. So he's a real drug discovery, drug development firepower being brought to the machine learning for bio space, you know, quite rarely. And he originally studied pharmacology back in Germany, in Frankfurt. And then, you know, we were also joined by someone, you know, very young founder leader, Sean McLean, who I believe is still only in his mid 30s and has already achieved a huge, huge amount. So he's the founder, CEO, director of Absci. And he's been the CEO since way back in August 2011 and a member of the board of directors since the foundation. He has studied in University of Arizona, has a degree in molecular and cell biology, and originally co-founded the company. And, you know, I think we talk about it a little bit through the podcast, but one of the things I think is very impressive about Sean is he's one of those very few founder innovators who will get out in front and just champion his own science and you know, has the knowledge and the wherewithal to do it. I met him originally a few times at different conferences, but one memorable time he was standing in front of his own poster talking about the science of Absci to essentially a group of PhD students who were quizzing him sideways on the technology. And, you know, that's really, really rare in someone who's leading a NASDAQ company. So that was exciting to see.
So the reason Absci is interesting to us and generally the idea of AI drug discovery is, you know, as they'll describe, you can potentially compress the time and the amount of money that needs to be spent to get a drug from kind of like, this is a target we're going after, to this is something that's ready to go into the clinic, and even go up front of that, even using artificial intelligence to actually determine which target you should go after with which part of the protein complex you should go after to address a specific disease. Charlie, do you think that this is like, we have enough capability now for that sort of thing to work?
Yeah, look, I think we are seeing a really historic change in the overall ROI and the efficiency and the ability to deliver insights and turn them into therapies than we've ever seen. You know, we're really seeing time compression. We're seeing massive increases in the amount of progress per unit of cost and time, and just a higher hit rate overall. And Absci is really one of the companies spearheading that direction. And, you know, even you know, we're not alone in saying this, though I think it's still rare and not widely priced in or believed by the market. But, you know, even if you look at, you know, folks like Deloitte this year have just finally published saying, actually, look, pharma R&D efficiency is finally turning. And this is even within big pharma. We believe that biopharma R&D, you know, with the nimbleness that comes there, is even more efficient. And, you know, quite a lot of data that that's the case. And Absci is just really one of the examples where you can very tangibly stick numbers on how much better it is than it was before. And you don't need to tip the scales much in favor of efficiency to really have a massive leveraged outcome in the number of drugs approved per $1 billion or what have you. So it's very, very exciting. And
yeah. And so then that translates into basically dollar in leads to more dollars coming back from an investor perspective. And potentially what I find exciting about the space is as you know, they have a kind of wet lab in the loop. So as they are seeing success, that should feed back into improving the models they use to then make their drug discovery even better. And I, so I have this working theory that like the ways in which right now, drug manufacturers are big is because they have very strong distribution. This isn't a theory. This is like demonstrated. Like large cap pharma is basically a giant sales force attached to an M&A acquisitions team that then provides them with molecules to sell. And so, but they got big because you need the scale to do the sales, right? And actually, this could be a different vector that causes kind of like this companies to become big in the innovation side of drug discovery, rather than that being a totally fragmented space where everybody has like IP rights over little like particular technologies or particular endpoints, right?
Right, and the bringing of people with the firepower of drug discovery, drug development expertise, as someone like Andreas, who's on the podcast, also, you know, brings two nimble machine learning AI enabled biotechs the ability to actually prosecute those products right through. And of course, some of them will get partnered, and it's been announced that Absci has already partnered with folks like AstraZeneca. And in fact, a very senior ex-AstraZeneca executive, Mene Pangalos, is on the board and is also on the board of Biogen now that just got announced. And so, but there's this, with this compression, with the ability to actually prosecute some of those programs right through and earn them, own them, you know, we believe that companies like Absci really have the potential to become the scaled biotech platform companies of tomorrow, like the Regenerons and the Genentechs, but in much faster of a time because of that compression and the efficiency gains. And while some of these programs will be partnered, many will be owned right through. And if you look at the sort of the famous numbers about the $2.6 billion or whatever it takes to ship a drug to the right through to approval, that factors in a lot of failure. Any individual drug can obviously be developed for much, much, much cheaper than that. And we believe that that's coming down by maybe orders of magnitude eventually, even from there. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned, the biology, that's interesting to highlight is the biology platform. So Absci almost has these two tracks where a lot is about drugging known biology, known targets much, much better. And there's a lot of headroom there. There's a huge TAM and a huge opportunity there. But Absci also has an angle on addressing maybe the biggest unmet need, if you look at the coming decades of cures, which is around biology. And they've got a very, really very innovative and it appears highly effective way of backing into those biological discoveries from using the human. So studying the human and the way that the human's immune system has built antibodies against the problem, which is just a very nice innovative. There's a couple of other companies doing something somewhat similar. So it's sort of, you know, enough of a validated space with a few folks going after, but it seems that Absci has got a really differentiated angle on that. And I think we touched on it a little bit in the discussion, but the use of AI to model sequences, both to analyze them, and in this case, sequences as in proteins and other omics, both in analyzing them and then predicting what would be, in a generative sense, that is an extremely good and underused use of AI. And, you know, we see it in language elsewhere, but it's just really entering the phase at which a few players are doing this in biology. And Absci is one of the leaders, and, you know, there's some other very interesting companies. So Alex Reeves, ex-Facebook AI, has got a private company also doing different, but again, part of the same philosophy. And also Jakob Uskerite, ex one of the Transformer authors, actually one of the eight Transformer authors, also has a very interesting company called Inceptive, which is also using sequence AI models in his case over the use of over RNA, but also taking that philosophical view that these are just language and they're sequences, and in that sequence is knowledge, and you can learn that knowledge by using these sequence models, much as a GPT does over language. And, you know, we think that's a very exciting direction. Definitely watch this space. And, you know, we think we'll see a lot of other discoveries in that direction.
Yeah. And, you know, of all of the areas that we study, I would say that biology is the most data rich for. So there's a reason to believe that having this magical new tool that can interpret and interpolate vast sums of data is going to have like a very impactful practical application in the biological space. We've had an abundance of data. The healthcare sector has more data than any other sector, but they just haven't known what to do with it or how to use it. And so kind of the promise here is, oh, now we have a tool that we can plug into these data sets to then, at least on the ab side or the drug side, to actually, you know, be smarter about developing drugs towards the thing that we're trying to achieve for the patient. And so we hope you enjoy the conversation. Look out for the anecdote late in it where we have to end the mouse monopoly on antibody design. It's just like a little needle in the haystack out there for you to listen to. Charlie, thanks for joining us, and enjoy the interview.
Thank you, Brett.
Today, we have a great conversation with me today. I'm happy to have Sean McClain. Sean, you are the founder and CEO of Absci. You founded the company in 2011, and really, Absci is at the forefront of linking AI to drug discovery and development, particularly in the biologic space. Absci is positioned to really lead in that area. And part of being a great leader is you've brought on great talent. So, Andreas Busch, if I'm pronouncing your last name correctly, I think I am, is from a traditional pharma background. You were 13 years at Bayer as, you know, global head of drug discovery, brought a bunch of products to market, and chief scientific officer and head of R&D at Shire. So, Sean, you've really taken somebody from the traditional space into the next generation of drug discovery. Welcome, and thank you for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us. And I think you're going to learn throughout this presentation. We're definitely a very multilingual team. It takes a whole army and village of folks that know a lot of different skill sets to truly make tech bio and AI drug discovery work.
Sean, maybe we could start out with you. Could you lay out why, why AI should be used to kind of drive drug discovery, and why now? Like, you founded the company in 2011. But clearly, we're in a different day and age than we were then. How is Absci positioned? And how do you think the entire industry is going to change as AI changes the way we do drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think really where Absci is focused is using AI to solve the design problem. So you can, you know, scientists can now test hypotheses that they haven't been able to test before. And you know, let's dive into that. Let's look at these undruggable targets like GPCRs or ion channels. These targets that have known biology but existing ways of discovering antibodies or small molecules have been difficult in order to ultimately drug these targets. But what if you could actually take AI and design those drug candidates or those antibodies to these undruggable targets, starting to unlock new novel biology? And that's really where we're focused, both on our internal pipeline, but also with partners, you know, partners like AstraZeneca, Almirall and Merck. These are, pharma partners that have, struggled with the same thing we're struggling with. And, I think these partnerships, again, are allowing us to leverage domain expertise that pharma has in therapeutic areas while leveraging our AI platform to unlock these novel biology and novel drugs that we can ultimately take into the clinic. And kind of you know, stepping back a little bit, you know, talking about Absci's, you know, history, we were not an AI first company. We built a synthetic biology platform that allowed us to scale protein-protein interactions, essentially how antibody-based drugs interact with a target of interest. And so to make an antibody efficacious or actually work, you need to hit the right location on the target and the right affinity. And essentially, this platform that we discovered allowed us to you know, traditionally go from screening thousands of drug candidates in a given week to being able to screen millions. And, you know, that was right around the time, you know, 2018 when Transformers were taking off with Google, these first, you know, Gen AI models. And it was like this idea of like, wow, if we could take this data of protein-protein interactions with these generative AI models, we could really go from this paradigm of searching for a needle in the haystack to actually creating the needle, in our case, a biologic or an antibody-based drug. And this would allow us to start to unlock, again, this kind of novel biology in these undruggable targets, such as, you know, ion channels, GPCRs. And again, going back, it allows you to actually test hypotheses that you haven't been able to test before. And you know, where the field's headed and where I'm really excited is ultimately being able to start to predict some of the biology. So once you solve the design problem, how do you figure out what targets we should be going after that are, you know, ultimately going to give us the efficacious you know, results that we want? Because we all know we can design an amazing molecule, but if it's not to the right target, it doesn't really matter. And so that's where we brought in, you know, expertise like on Andreas Busch, amazing drug hunters that can help us take, you know, this you know, technology we've developed and help us apply it to the right targets and the right biology. And when you do that, I think you really unlock I think really exciting therapies for patients.
Andreas, you kind of jumped in later in the game than Sean did, at least on the Absci side. And some would argue and say, well, okay, sure, AI is going to help here. but wouldn't you rather be in an organization with all of the vast resources that can kind of throw at this problem rather than go into a startup? Why kind of, you know, skydive out of a giant mothership into something specifically focused on kind of like data generation into AI and drug discovery, rather than kind of just trying to make it happen in a large pharma company?
To be honest, when I was responsible for R&D at a large pharma company, AI was always a platform which I assume would take over a number of aspects of discovery and development. However, that was at a time where a number of things were missing. The talent to join Big Pharma was missing. The data in its quantity and quality were missing. And also the complete understanding, how do we connect all of those individual components in this complex aspect of drug discovery? I mean, Shaw just mentioned that, you know, we are addressing right now the beast of basically generating the perfect antibody or biologic against a given target. However, he also made clear it's absolutely critical that we have the right target. And now if you think about the right target, how much it involves to get the right target, it again is a multidimensional aspect, you know, trying to translate data from a human being to an animal or back, from a healthy to a sick human, and understand overall the plethora of data you need to understand in order to go forward and then get to the point that a good target requires a good entity to address it is clearly a complex aspect which is not really well covered by an organization, by the R&D organization of a big pharma, where I believe you have, on the one hand, very good oversight in what is needed, but on the other hand, you don't have the deep expertise on the individual components. And I think it's to me at least very clear that more and more big pharma companies understand that this deep expertise and how to generate and optimize an antibody, the deep expertise really going about signaling pathways, understanding toxicology, pathology, and so forth. You want to really dig into the experts, which are very often biotechs, which are very often outside of the own internal pharma company and the pharma expertise.
That's interesting. So Andreas, you actually, just to paraphrase, you actually think you can build, because obviously pharma, you know, the industry looks to and thinks there's a lot of expertise there, but is that what you're saying, that sometimes it's, I mean, it makes sense on, say, deep AI expertise, but even within biology, you're saying you can actually find or build greater expertise on a certain application area in a biotech, if I understood correctly.
That's what I assume. I mean, I think what we have to appreciate right now, not right now, I think always, is that the game we're playing is really at the end a talent game. And we have to always understand, you know, what talent gets attracted by what type of background and organization. And I would say that this very specific talent, which you need to solve a very difficult question, a very focused, difficult question, is more likely to be attracted by a highly innovative startup, you know, which comes with a proposition of, hey, you know, if we are successful here, we're either going to win the Nobel Prize or we generate equity, which is amazing to you. Both is attractive to a young scientist. Whereas if you look at who is attracted at the end of the day by big pharma, it is people who want to bring drugs forward and translate somehow ideas, but they also love the safe environment. They always love, you know, the aspect of knowing, you know, if they build a house for their family, you know, they don't have to move the next month. So I think, you know, it is, there has to be an appreciation of, you know, what drives certain industries. And very often it is talent acquisition. At least this is my big experience. And if you look at the efforts the big companies have spent to build up internal expertise, especially around AI, how much they've invested compared to a number of biotechs, it's amazing to see, you know, that still at the end of the day, they rely very much on making partnerships for the right reasons.
Even in the context of Absci, there is a degree to which there's like, so Absci, or my understanding of the approach is you can go for a best-in-class treatment where the biology has largely been proven out, but you can use some of the tools you have to deliver something that, you know, has longer dwell time in the body, so you don't have to dose as frequently, or, you know, is basically like, or better binding affinity, so it's like actually going to be more efficacious. And then there's a almost separate kind of hypothesis that, hey, we can actually understand and generate novel biological kind of like assets. Can one of those like theses kind of succeed while the other does not? Or does the success of one indicate that the other is going to succeed? And how do you think about kind of like strategically the approach, and AIs call it, you know, potential to lead really differentiated results in each of those areas?
I can take this, and then, you know, Andreas can comment. But I think it comes down to a diversified portfolio. And I think with every platform company, whether it's, you know, AI driven or not, you need to make sure that the first asset that goes into the clinic, one, it's able to prove your platform and your technology, and two, the you know, you ensure that the biology, you know, plays out. And I think that we could have taken an approach where, you know, we take a bet on the technology, and we also take a bet on the new biology. But I think that that's too much risk. And so what we decided to do on the first asset, TL1A, was, you know, we saw that, you know, the IBD space, it's a very large market. We started pursuing TL1A before the Prometheus phase 2 readout, and then shortly after Merck ended up acquiring. Prometheus based on the phase two proof of concept work. And we really believed in that biology, but the biology was de-risked. It was already in the clinic, but we saw ways of improving the molecule, both on potentially increasing the overall efficacy of it, but also increasing overall patient convenience. And we focused in on basically making a second generation TL1A asset that would have both of those attributes potentially. And we believe that that's a great approach because, again, you de-risk on the biology side, but you're able to show a big win on the board from a technology standpoint and how your technology was able to generate a differentiated asset. Now, that's our first asset. Now, if you kind of look at ABS-301, it's the complete opposite, where this is a novel IO target. It's novel biology. We fundamentally believe in it. We have some exciting results that are going to be coming out at our R&D day on December 12th on the in vivo efficacy. But that's going to be obviously a lot higher risk moving forward than a best in class approach like on our TL1A asset. And this is where you have to have domain expertise like Andreas, who is an expert drug hunter, I mean, over 10 drugs approved, to really look at the pipeline and the targets we're going after and being like, are these good targets to go after, both from a best-in-class perspective, as well as, first-in-class. And so getting the targets right, whether, whatever strategy you have is super critical. And I think it can make or break a biotech company. And Andreas, I mean, please weigh in. I mean, you know better than anybody, how important, getting the target selection is, as well as the right strategy and the right blend of first-in-class, best-in-class.
For sure. I think you took away my thunder already. So, let me maybe add that I think this is the most decisive aspect of most pharma companies, finding exactly, the right balance, how we structure a portfolio. And in general, you can distinguish between those two aspects, the best in class versus the first in class. And they all come with different risk. If you look for the best in class, it's pretty obvious that the one number one technical risk, which is that at the end of the day, starting from a target to approval, you lose about 99% of your approaches. Or if you now go to a later phase in the R&D discovery value chain, proof of concept, if you generate a proof of concept, you really avoid about 80% attrition. So you really have to think of best in class of, I take away a lot of the scientific risk. If I go really with a target which has shown a proof of concept in patients, just think about it. It means, it got through toxicology, got through CMC issues. It showed, and that's the most important aspect, an appropriate profile in patients, which makes me believe it's going to be a drug for the first time. For the first time, not before. So you really cut a risk dramatically. Well, having said that, why wouldn't everybody do that? Well, obviously, you add commercial risk. You add the risk, that you're number 75. So you have to exactly understand, where is the sweet spot? Where is it really where best in class means a very relevant difference to the patients, which is appreciated by healthcare providers, which is appreciated by reimbursement. So you have to find exactly that sweet spot where you are among, I would say, depending on the market size, the top 3-4 companies, where you really know that you can differentiate from the first in class in very meaningful parameters. At the same time, like Charles said, if we have the chance, while building up our portfolio, with the first asset and the second asset as a best-in-class approach, if you have the chance of getting first-in-class with a somewhat de-risked approach, of course, you will end up with a highly innovative but more risky target. And this is what we're doing with our reverse immunology platform, where we are in a situation of, yes, we come up with targets where nobody else, as far as we know, would work on right now, which, however, are already somewhat validated because we start off with a human antibody identified in a tertiary lymphoid structure. And therefore, you know, we are much further away from the typical, oh, I find this type of overexpression here, and, you know, a hypertrophic mouse displays this here. So you start off, at least at the beginning, with a somewhat higher validation than you usually would. Does that mean it de-risks the project? Well, to a certain extent, but it still is much, much higher risk, much, much higher risk than the first approach on the technical side, not on the commercial side, of course. Yeah.
Can you talk about the specifically to, let's start with best in class, like that approach? How does AI actually help you there? Or how does what you're doing actually get you to the ability? Like I said, it's like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. I'll throw some money at getting there. Why can't I get there, but you can? Like, what are you doing that's different from how it is traditionally done that yields kind of like that better binding efficiency and dwell time?
In terms of, you know, what we're able to, you know, deliver on, I think it's you know, threefold. I think first it's differentiation. So being able to, you know, let's look at, you know, TL1A for example. With that, there were some known liabilities with the known competitor molecules that were out there. You saw, you know, with the Roivant molecule, you saw increased ADA response when compared to the Prometheus Merck molecule. And we saw that was likely B-cell mediated. So essentially, where the antibody was binding to the target was leading to immunogenicity. And so we took that into account when designing this molecule. And we essentially were able to design a antibody that bound to an adjacent epitope to the Merck, which we believed was a conserved epitope that would decrease overall immunogenicity when compared to the Roivant molecule. We then engineered the molecule to have high potency, so binding with high affinity, and we were able to show that we could have differentiation there. And then one area that we see as additional differentiation could lead to potential increased efficacy is being able to bind to both the monomeric version of TL1A as well as the trimeric version. And what you see with the competitor molecules is that you either get, you know, binding to the monomer and no binding to the trimer, or very, you know, weak binding to the trimer. And we believe by using the AI model to bind to both of those versions, we could potentially increase overall efficacy. And so that's how we use and I guess the last piece I forgot to mention was increasing overall half-life. So being able to engineer the molecule to stay in the body longer, so you have less dosing frequency. So like going towards kind of patient convenience. So instead of dosing once monthly, you dose once quarterly. So that's how we're using AI to create a differentiated asset. Now, the other, you know, area that we're using, you know, AI to, you know, to accelerate this, and we really believe to kind of break the paradigm of how the economics of biotech traditionally work, is we were able to use these AI models to rapidly get to a drug candidate. So we were able to get to a drug candidate in 14 months. You know, normally that could take 2 to 3 years to get to a drug candidate. We're going to be in the clinic with this asset within 24 months. So early next year, we'll be in the clinic. Normally that takes 5.5 years to get into the clinic. So we're cutting the time in half. And then additionally, we invested roughly $13 to $15 million to get this asset into the clinic. Traditionally, call it $50 to $100 million it would take to get a normal asset into the clinic. And so we're able to completely change the paradigm and economics of how traditional biotech has worked. And so you're able to get more shots on goal with the same amount of investment. So instead of investing, you know, $100 million into, you know, one asset, you could invest that $100 million into 5 to 10 assets. And that doesn't even take into account those assets you're developing are more differentiated, which means that you're likely going to have higher probability of success in the clinic. And so that's how, from an economics perspective, we believe AI is going to completely disrupt how R&D is done.
These feel like a very important, you know, massive accelerator and catalyst of overall for the industry, right? And for companies like AppSci in particular, that we study and think about a lot. Because if you look at, you know, if you take the view that we didn't really have modern medicine, say 100 years ago, you know, by some measures we've made great progress, but also things, you know, move way slower than we like. And particularly things are much more expensive than we like. And if you took out the institutional university funding, the grant bodies, and all of the bust biotechs along the way that didn't get acquired, you know, I don't know if anyone's ever run the numbers. It's a pretty tricky one to make, but arguably drug R&D historically has barely wiped its own face overall as an ROI, you know, compared to other sectors. And I think, you know, some of that's filtering through into what we're seeing in the public markets right now with this historic number of negative EV biotechs on the public markets. And I think you don't have to increase efficiency and speed or, you know, decrease cost that much to really tip the scales in favor of this is a good thing to do. And I think with the kind of speed up you're seeing, you know, that becomes very exciting. Is it possible to double click a little bit on how the AI actually does drive progress at different parts of the pipeline? Because I think one of the things, if we look at, you know, the GPT revolution, one of the things these models are very good at doing is, I think one of the reasons we're very excited about AppSci's technology is modeling sequences is a very good use of these things. Modeling complex nonlinear interactions in a very high dimensional space that's difficult for a human to model. And we see that in natural language, but, you know, you seem to be at the forefront of doing that within biology. And it'd be great to understand, you know, double click a bit on that and talk about the challenges and the enablers for that to deliver molecules ultimately.
Yeah. So essentially, like what we're doing with these, you know, models is we're first off, you know, training on sequence-based data. So data that's coming from the ACE assay that we had developed, where we're able to multiplex, antibodies, binding to targets of interest and looking at, you know, what epitope is it binding to, what affinity. And then additionally, what we're able to do is also leverage, you know, publicly available data on the structure of protein-protein in interaction. So you have a structural based component as well. And essentially these go into various different models like, you know, diffusion based models, graph neural nets. And, you know, we've gotten to the point now where we can take a target of interest. We can specify the epitope or the location that you want the antibody to bind to. And so the input is the three-dimensional structure. So you have to have the structure of the target for the model to work. And that can be derived experimentally through like cryo-EM or X-ray crystallography, or you can use something like AlphaFold as the input or the structure from AlphaFold as the input. And from there, again, you specify where you want the antibody to bind. And then the model is then able to design the CDRs. So think of the CDRs as almost like the fingers that grab onto to the target of interest. You have six fingers that are important for binding to a target. And the model is able to design those CDRs that can bind to that particular epitope of interest. Now, this may sound really simple, but if you think about how things are currently done, you have no ability to design an antibody to hit an epitope of interest. This is the first time ever scientists have the ability to design an antibody to an epitope of interest that has the affinity that they want. Because if you look at current approaches, one of the most kind of recognized ways of creating antibodies, and it goes actually back to one of the great biotechs that we have today, Regeneron. Regeneron, you know, created the humanized mouse to generate antibodies. So essentially, what they do is they take cancer antigen of interest, they inject it into the mouse, and the mouse uses its immune system to generate an antibody that binds to that target. And then they take those antibodies and they screen and figure out which of these gives me the the ultimate biology of interest. But the issue that you have with that is you have no ability to control how the mouse immune system generates the antibody. So you can't tell a mouse to generate an antibody to a particular area of the target. The mouse gives you what the mouse gives you. And so now we're able to use AI to design the antibodies to have all the attributes that you want, whether that's to hit this particular epitope to create an agonism antibody or antagonist, or have a particular affinity that you want to test, again, these hypotheses that you haven't been able to test before. And I think a great example of this is actually our partnership with AstraZeneca. So we ended up closing a partnership with AstraZeneca late last year, started on the program earlier this year. And this is a program that is focused on an oncology target that has been a struggle for them to produce antibodies towards. And we identified six epitopes that we wanted the antibodies to bind to. And again, there are no known binders to this target. And we were able to successfully design six antibodies, we were able to design antibodies to these six epitopes. And this was a huge accomplishment because, again, this was a target that folks had struggled to drug, and you now have an AI model that can generate a drug candidate to this really exciting target. That's a huge breakthrough. Now, whether or not the biology actually pans out, is a different point. But the point is that this has the ability to completely change the game on how we think about the design. How can we more rapidly test these drug candidates. And so I think it's a huge breakthrough on being able to have a model that is epitope specific, again, testing hypotheses that you wouldn't be able to test before, and really solving the design problem of antibodies.
Is that same model, wait, I'm going to get to you in a second, Andres, is that same model, is it usable in the kind of like antibody creation optimization space and in the kind of, hey, we're going to go after novel biology space, or do you have different approaches to those?
So we have two different approaches, and Andres can touch on this. So this is more hitting on the design, using this AI model to design the antibodies for, let's say, a best-in-class strategy. But then we have our reverse immunology platform, which Andreas was touching on, which allows us to discover these new novel targets to go after. So there are two separate platforms that we have here. One is design of antibodies, and then the other is target ID.
Very little to add. Maybe I want to add a couple of aspects which Shah has not mentioned on top of the ones he has mentioned, which is, doing it that way, generating de novo a binder, we also end up with an incredible diversity of the CDR region, which gives you a complete new playground for generating IP, because it's not just the one sequence of maybe plus one minus amino acid for which you can generate IP, but you can get, basically the entire CDR. You can get protected because you. We saw, if we compare to trastuzumab at our HER2 binders, which we generated, we saw binders, with a distance to the original trastuzumab, with a distance of 9 to 10 amino acids, so we could exchange 9 to 10 amino acids to still get a very potent binder. So I think that is one of those aspects, which is in the context of value generation super important, that once you have generated this antibody, the chance is very, very high that nobody can touch this IP or do a little change. That's one of the things which I want to add. Then, yes, we are working very hard to fuse, on the one hand, the de novo model to generate the antibodies with our model, which at this point is still separate, to optimize the molecules. It still goes pretty fast. You know, within a few weeks, we can, you know, apply the model to optimize the antibodies from the first binders we get. And that, again, is very, very important to keep in mind. How is it done traditionally versus what we can do? We can address aspects like affinity, half-life, ADCC. We can address pH-dependent binding and so forth all at once, doing a multidimensional optimization, and we know exactly what we want to do. That is very different to the mouse. I always tell Shaw, yes, you can tell the mouse what you want. Unfortunately, the mouse doesn't listen to you, and the mouse, you know, spits out what it spits out. So we can do that. And then the final aspect, which wasn't covered yet, it's nice to be fast. It's nice to be fast. But why is it so nice to be fast? It's not just because of the costs. You know, I mean, working on a project for a year clearly costs you less than working on it for 3-4 years. But you have to, again, keep in mind the competitive advantage you gain out of that. You know, a year in the present R&D value chain is gigantic. If you keep in mind that everybody with the present methods is working on the same targets, everybody, you know, is, oh, when I say everybody, I would say there's always 3-4 competitors, you know, working on the same target. 1 year is not a little bit more or a little bit less of the value. It may be digital. It may be all of the value or zero of the value. So I think we have to keep in mind what time really means and what a year means. It doesn't just mean if you have a blockbuster that you earn 1 more billion at the end of the life cycle. It may mean that you get it all or you get nothing.
Can I unpack one thing you said? So you were describing, essentially, if you imagine you have like the spot you're supposed to plug in on the protein here, and using your methods, you discover a spot that's maybe over here, and then you can IP protect like essentially everything around the derivations of what you're doing, such that it would be hard for somebody to be like, oh yeah, that looks like a good spot to operate in, and be like, okay, we're just going to change one amino acid and actually land there, because you've like actually IP protected the position much more completely. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yes. That's usually where Sean jumps in, but yes, that's more or less what I try to say. If you look at, for example, the trastuzumab, you know, CDR3 region, which we have de novo designed, you know, it's 13 amino acids, and we come up with binders where we exchanged 11 of them, and they still, you know, produced a good binder. So, you know, there's no room left really to search for any changes you can make.
Yeah, to put it in perspective, I mean, that there's more sequence variants in an antibody than there are atoms in the universe. And so it doesn't matter, you know, how robust your screening platform is, you're just never going to be able to screen that many antibodies. But what, you know, these AI models are allowing you to do is actually start to explore that much larger search space. And, you know, what's, you know, we find actually quite interesting now, especially after the Amgen Sanofi case, which, you know, really showed that you need to show enablement in order to get broad claims. You know, I think, you know, the Amgen was trying to get a whole target claimed based on, you know, 14 to 20 antibodies, I forget, but it was a very small amount of antibodies that bound to this target. They wanted to get, you know, broad claims, and the US you know, PTO came back and said that they didn't have enough examples to issue a broad claim towards that target. But now if you can actually use the AI to, you know, search that whole search space and come up with millions of designs towards that given target, and then not only that, you have the wet lab to go then screen those million antibodies, you now have enablement to get much broader IP claims than you could have ever gotten before. So you actually need both. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't touched on yet. And I think that that's one of the big reasons why we've had the success that we've had is, and you know, Charlie and I have talked about this a ton, is this active learning loop. Being able to generate data in the wet lab, a physical wet lab, and you know, feed that data into your model, train your model, and then be able to go validate the model, see how accurate that model is. And we're able to go through that active learning loop right now in 6 weeks. And so we're able to generate billions of protein-protein interactions to train our models. And then we're able to, you know, look at 3 million unique AI-generated antibody designs and validate them to see how accurate the models are. I mean, that throughput, as well as that cycle time of 6 weeks, is really the best in the industry, or the best of what we've seen. And we're constantly looking to drive that cycle time down, because the faster we can drive that cycle time down, that 6 week time period right now, to, you know, not just weeks, but to days, that's going to allow us to dramatically increase the overall accuracy and predictability of these models. And Andreas talked about kind of two separate models. We have the de novo model that's like your global search. So, you know, basically, you know, you want to hit the country you want, and then you have the local, you know, optimization. You know, you hit the city that you want. But ultimately, as you get more and more data, these models actually start to you know, converge, and you can hit the city and the right country at the same time. And so you can get both, like, let's say, the efficacy of the model, or the molecule, plus the developability and manufacturability all in one go. But in order to get there, you got to get the right amount of data, and you got to have that active learning loop. And that's what's really led to the success that we've had. And we wouldn't be where we're at if we didn't have that active learning loop at that 6 week time period.
Definitely seeing a rise of people talking about, you know, good biotechs operating at the beach, right, where wet meets dry. And then, you know, we think the next level is the kind of active learning that you're doing, and you're handing over the cars to the sort of robot scientist, and maybe eventually the founder can go and sit on the beach. But those days are probably still a little ways out.
I don't know exactly what I would do on a beach, though, at that point in time.
Dream up the next biotech, maybe. I mean, sort of leads into a couple of other questions I had about, first of all, you know, thanks for highlighting some of the combinatorial complexity that you deal with, because it's just fascinating in biology how quickly it blows up. Someone told me a great stat the other day that I did objectively check, and it is roughly accurate. If you spent your entire life doing nothing but reading your own 3 billion base pair genome at the rate of one base a second, it would take you your entire life, like a century, almost exactly. And that's just that one genome with no variants. So fascinating. And of course, it blows up very quickly. And I think it's one thing just for our listeners as well that you've, you know, identified, but it's not necessarily super obvious to people from outside of bio, is that, as you've said, function essentially is modulated by structure in biology, whether that's, you know, antibody structure, drug structure, other things. And that's, in the case of proteins and antibodies, modulated by sequence. So you're operating up at the sequence level where AI is really good, and training on the outcome, which is the functional output. And I think that drawing the line between those things is super, super important. And I guess my question was, how much biology is there? Like, as you sort of in the limit, as you sort of look out 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, how much of the current biology is understood that will form those drugs of the future? Like, where are we on that kind of exploitation, exploration, i.e. first in class versus best in class, and in terms of the future pipeline that humanity has to play with? Where do you think we are on that journey?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, where we're at right now is, like, we've built scalable biology for, you know, predicting protein-protein interactions. And, you know, now where we're looking to scale data is on the in vitro side and the in vivo side. And if we can effectively figure out how can we scale the cell-based assays, and how can we, you know, scale, you know, animal studies, it, or at least have a model that can mimic animal studies, you know, very, very effectively, that's when you can start to, you know, model the biology and start predicting, you know, what targets to go after. Not only, like, what targets, but what epitope on that target should you be hitting to give you the overall efficacy that you want. how do you ensure that you get a antagonist antibody versus an agonist antibody? And I think like all of these pieces, I do believe that we're going to solve, but we do need the data in order to inform these models, for these models to be accurate enough to really start to be predicting the biology. And so that's kind of a big focus for us. But I do believe in the next 5+ years, I think we're going to be at the point where you're able to have these AI models, actually start to recommend, epitopes you should be looking at, recommending what targets to be looking at in order to achieve the biology that you want for a given, indication or therapeutic area. So I think that's where everything is headed. I don't believe that we are there yet on actually using AI to predict the exact, target and getting the right mechanism in place and, having great success of having that pan out in the clinic. I think we are very much getting, towards that direction. But I think there are, some limitations there, but I do believe that's where we'll be in the next like five plus years. I don't know. It's incredible just how fast things are progressing. I mean, I don't know. It could happen in 2 to 3 years versus 5.
Andreas, and under that circumstance, is the portfolio mix just hugely biased towards first in class as opposed to best in class? Or do you think you're always going to have kind of like a mix? Is going after best in class just a way to de-risk the platform? And ultimately, you think that Absci will be targeting, hey, we're discovering new biology and we're targeting it? Or do you think it'll kind of blend?
Right now, our front runners are best in class. And certainly, with the next generation of assets we bring into our portfolio, we try to have a somewhat de-risked first in class. And I guess what John tried to indicate is that at the end of the day, of getting early targets before you have any better idea of, how an entity against it really works, de-risk, you need tons of data. And this is what is happening right now. I mean, if you look at the data generation as we see it right now, both on the human side, look at just all the GWAS studies we get, which we can analyze with potentially very soon, artificial intelligence, about all other genetic data we get, about all sorts of disease data we get at the really high scale of quantity and quality. That all will accelerate, but again, we're not there yet, but that all will accelerate understanding better human pathophysiology and the value of an individual target. Yes, we're not there yet, very, very clearly. As, by the way, whatever we talked about today, we want to further improve. Whatever we talked about today, we're not there yet, but we really feel we are on a good way to get ultimately where we want to get, which is, we have an idea about a target, it gets validated very quickly, and then we really can generate one hit of a button, an optimized antibody de novo, and can put it into the right models to test it biologically. This is the idea and the vision we're living for and working our butts off right now. It's difficult to exactly say when for 100% of all targets we can deliver that. Always keep that in mind. Today we know there are targets around where this works already. But what our ambition, of course, is we want all targets to work. We want especially the targets to work, which are, historically undruggable. All those things we want to address with what we're doing right now. And I think we have a good start and we are on our way. But what we can say, we're not there yet, but we assume we're going to be faster there than we actually think. Because if you look at what the contribution of AI was and how things developed over the past 5 years, if you look at the interview of David Baker, it's very clear that most of the advances really happened over the last 5 years, because you got this combination of great scientists getting together with the right models, technologies, building on each other, but a huge wealth of data being generated on the other side. And I think this is why it's not so easy to predict, you know, are we going to be there by the end of the year or next year? But I think overall, we are optimistic that we're there much faster than probably we'd probably expect.
Well, we're definitely, as investors, of course, but fellow entrepreneurs and certainly just for society and as people with families and what have you, we're cheering you on, you know, super exciting and important to drive better outcomes from the immune system modulation, especially because, you know, there's great data, actually, there's a huge amount, as you all will know well, a huge amount of aging is actually immune degradation, thymic involution, leading to everything from obviously cancer, but also infectious diseases and various other things. And, you know, we're seeing increasing evidence of contribution to even neurodegeneration and a ton of other diseases that the lack of understanding and the lack of our ability to modulate the immune system has led to.
One sentence you just made, you know, so much more is known about aging. And I tell you, nothing is closer to my heart than thinking about mechanism to act on, which can clearly in help enhancing a healthy and extending a healthy longer life. But now we come to the next problem, which is translating a wonderful mechanism with a wonderful compound into an appropriate clinical study. So Charles, you have to help me there. How I would study extension of life in a way which would be accepted by regulatory agencies. Anyway, sorry, I just need...
I feel podcast 2.0, the sequel, as a little cliffhanger. I mean, look, I think there's some interesting work that is going on and could be done around a panoply of sort of aging markers, but including things like the Horvath clock, right, the methylation clocks, which are looking like reasonable proxies, though with their problems, right, not least of which that they show cell type is a bigger driver of those. But I think like those problems are being understood. Maybe there's ways to understand them. But even at different age ranges, things like grip strength and ability to walk, like there's a bunch of stuff, right? The ability to stand on one leg. It's kind of a comedy biomarker, but it's quite a good one. And so there's a bunch of things that, you know, I'd love to debate on another podcast because it's definitely an area close to heart too. Just to close out though, maybe, you know, John, I think one of the things that really impressed me about you as an entrepreneur and Absci as a company was, I mean, we'd met each other before, but effectively bumping into you in the maelstrom of Neurips, the machine learning conference, where I think you probably were uniquely the only CEO of like a $500 million odd market cap company standing there defending and presenting your company's technology and your thinking to essentially a crew of PhD students at your own poster, which I thought that's just so cool and so rare to see both the level of knowledge to be able to do that, the willingness to do that, and just the excitement for the technology. Could you talk quickly about your own journey as an entrepreneur? And maybe, I mean, you're in your mid-30s, you've already achieved an amazing success with what you're building. And maybe advice for your even younger self of maybe a decade ago or what have you.
It's really about being a lifelong learner. And it's checking the ego at the door. And I think it's recognizing like what you don't know and what you do know, and really, you know, surrounding yourself with people smarter than yourself. My dad taught me that lesson at a young age. He's like, you know, hire people much smarter than yourself. And to do that, it means checking that ego at the door and recognizing like, you're not going to be the domain, you know, expert on everything. And that's okay. And, you know, hiring people, you know, like on Andreas that have come on, you know, folks like, you know, Zach Jonasson, who's our, you know, CFO and CBO. He was like the, you know, the venture partner, the first venture partner that put, you know, venture money into, you know, Absci, you know, folks, you know, even like Shelby Walker, we just, you know, brought on as our head of legal. I mean, I have learned so much from each of these, you know, individuals, and it's, I think, allowed me to become, I think, a very well-rounded CEO. And you know, it's allowed me to continue to stay curious. I think curiosity is what has driven me. And you know, being surrounded by these really smart people, it kind of helps me, you know, look at things from a different perspective. And at the end of the day, I think it helps, you know, make sure that, you know, the vision of Absci is crafted in the right way. We're going and we're rowing in the right direction. And it's kind of being able to kind of synthesize all the different, you know, inputs that are coming in and being able to say, okay, hey, this is the direction we need to be going. And here's where we need to be like doubling and tripling down. But if you don't have that, information, you're not curious, you're not surrounding yourself with people, you're not going to make the right decisions at the end of the day, because like you just don't have that information. And so I think to me, it's stay curious, hire people smarter than yourself, and just be a lifetime learner.
Well, on that note, I hope that the listeners of this podcast learned something from this conversation. I certainly did. And I really appreciate the two of you coming on, and we hope for the best for Absci, and think that, you know, generally, I think it's amazing how quickly the AI space is moving, and there's probably no higher leverage space than biology to deploy it against, because it's so data rich, and we really have like only the thinnest layer of understanding on top of that data as to what's going on. And so this seems like the way to find out and then deploy that data against, you know, real things that'll make a difference in people's lives. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us. This has been a ton of fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to leave a rating on whatever platform you're listening to. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.